When we are in this chapter, the philosophy of rebirth, well, it could be a revision. We'll stay from 11 and evolving universal life may have developed on earth. The growing personality that has now become ourselves before it entered a human body at all. The soul in us may have evolved in lower life shapes before man was created. In that case, our personality has previously inhabited animal forms, and the subtle body would be a plastic formation carried from birth to birth, but adapting itself to whatever physical shape the soul inhabits. So this is, of course, what we have already discussed, that the human soul before it comes to the human body has taken obviously many other lives, maybe in the plant world or in the animal world. But whatever it is, it has a precedence. No soul directly jumps straight into the human body. Of course, there are exceptions when there is the possibility of an involutionary soul and not an evolutionary soul. Apart from that, normally the souls would take many, many births through different forms before they come to the human. And he says, or the evolving life may be able to build a personality capable of survival, but only in the human form when that is created. This would happen by the force of a sudden growth of mental consciousness, and at the same time a seed of subtle mind substance might develop and help to individualize this mental consciousness, and would then function as an inner body, just as the gross physical form by its organization at once individualizes and houses the animal mind and life. Well, all this we did in our previous class, but only to revise that with the coming of the mental consciousness in the human body, the soul seems to have found at last a more or less a permanent form. And that's what we said in our last class, that it's important for the soul to reside in the human form because it gets the mental consciousness, which is the beginning of self-awareness. Because up until the human form, when there's no mental consciousness, the possibility of the self-awareness is not there. The animals are aware of their surroundings, but not aware of itself. And that happens only with the growth of the mental consciousness. And the psychic being an entity where the self-awareness begins to happen, the mind consciousness seems to be the right place for it to remain in a permanent form. On the former supposition, we must admit that the animal too survives the dissolution of the physical body and has some kind of soul formation, which after death occupies other animal forms on earth and finally a human body. For there is little likelihood that the animal soul passes beyond earth and enters other planes of life than the physical and constantly returns here until it is ready for the human incarnation. The animal's conscious individualization does not seem sufficient to bear such a transfer or to adapt itself to an otherworldly existence. Well, this also we have seen, that the animal consciousness, or we can say the soul formation in the animal, takes to what we have said, the transmigration. That means as soon as the animal is dead, then the soul formation in the animal takes immediately another body. For the simple reason that it has not developed the other levels of consciousness so that it could transcend into the other levels. You see, the human being can transcend beyond the physical, the subtle physical, the vital and the mental, because he has a mental consciousness. So wherever he is, the vital or the mental, human beings can go up to the mind and return. But whereas the animal is purely a physical creature with some of the vital, so it doesn't go beyond. So he says it constantly returns until it is ready for the human incarnation. So the animal birth takes hundreds of births, maybe thousands of births, whatever. And then slowly from birth to birth it matures, and at a certain stage it leaps into the human body. On the second supposition, the power thus to survive the death of the physical body in other states of existence would only arrive with the human stage of the evolution. If indeed the soul is not such a constructed personality evolved by life, but a persistent, unevolving reality with a terrestrial life and body as its necessary field, the theory of rebirth in the sense of Pythagorean transmigration would have to be admitted. Well, I think we need to almost till here. That is, even if the human soul, which has come down from many animal birth, after it takes the human form, takes up the human form, if it does not evolve, if it remains more or less on the animal consciousness level, then like the animal soul, the human soul also would do the transmigration. That means as soon as it leaves the human body, it will go to another human body. Because the same reason is not yet developed itself strong enough that it can go to the higher levels. So Sri Aurobindo is telling us that if it is only a persistent, unevolving reality, because this is what Sri Aurobindo tells us, that the psychic being is a constantly evolving being. But if there is any theory which says, no, there is nothing called spiritual evolution of the soul, then what Pythagore told us is true, that it goes from one body to another. But what Sri Aurobindo tells us is that the psychic being, depending upon its evolutionary stage, goes into the subtle physical worlds. But if it is a persistent evolving entity capable of passing beyond the terrestrial stage, then the Indian idea of a passage to other worlds and a return to terrestrial birth would become possible and highly probable. But it would not be inevitable. You see the linking phrase there. What we in India say that the soul goes to the higher levels, passes into the other world and returns to the earth, then there is a possibility that the soul could go into higher levels, come back, have a rebirth. But then suddenly Sri Aurobindo would say, but it would not be inevitable. For it might be supposed that the human personality, once capable of attaining to other planes, need not return from them. Why is Sri Aurobindo telling that it is not inevitable? That is, a human soul, once it goes into the higher levels of consciousness, the psychic plane, or there are other intuitive levels, once it goes there, it may enjoy that status so much so that it will feel, why should I go back to earth and suffer? So it may choose to stay back. But remember, all this is if we do not have the theory of spiritual evolution. We have said many a time that this question of the rebirth of the soul comes into, is uncontested only and only if we believe in a spiritual evolution of the soul. Otherwise, many theories could be right. So even this Indian theory of rebirth is right, but it doesn't give us the inevitability of the rebirth, because it says once the soul goes up, it may refuse to come back. So it would have perished with the terrestrial life evolution. Only if faced with actual evidence of a return to earth would a larger supposition be compulsory and the admission of a repeated rebirth in human forms become inevitable. So why is Sri Aurobindo's theory of spiritual evolution make rebirth inevitable? Because you see, even though the soul may reach higher levels of consciousness, it is bound to return, because there's always a higher level of progress. You can keep on evolving level after level, height after height. So the soul can never say, I have reached Ananda Loka and I am happy. But it has to come back upon earth and reach further heights of spiritual consciousness. And maybe, up until, as Sri Aurobindo tells us in another passage, until there is the supramental consciousness that really takes over the mental consciousness, the rebirth of the soul is inevitable. So that is why in Sri Aurobindo, it doesn't matter where you are, which level you may have reached, but the soul has to come back because it has infinite levels of consciousness to go to. Now in the next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is going to take up once again a little more in detail, because we have seen this idea before, the question of Buddhism. Because we have seen that the Buddhists believe in rebirth, but what kind of a rebirth is it? He says, but even then the developing vitalistic theory need not spiritualize itself, need not admit the real existence of a soul or its immortality or eternity. It might regard the personality still as a phenomenal creation of the universal life by the interaction of life consciousness and physical form and force, but with a wider, more variable and subtle action of both upon each other and another history than it had at first seen to be possible. It might even arrive at a sort of vitalistic Buddhism, admitting a karma, but admitting it only as an action of a universal life, life force. It would admit as one of its results the continuity of the stream of personality in rebirth by mental association, but might deny any real self for the individual or any eternal being other than this active, ever-active, vital becoming. Well, that's what I was referring to, because we had this explanation before, maybe in paragraph 7 or so. What happens here is that Buddhism speaks of a personality, what they call a stream of personality, which, as explained in the paragraph 7, a personality made up of ideas, memories, sensations and images. So in Buddhism there is no soul, there is no recognition of a psychic being. And yet they say there is the rebirth. But rebirth of what? Rebirth of a personality. What is this personality? It consists of my memories, of my images, of my associations. That means whatever I gather in this life, my relations with friends, my family, my experiences, all these things crystallize into a personality which, when the body is left behind, survives. And it is this personality that goes into the next body. But here there's no question, or at least it's not very obvious, that this personality goes into the other subtle physical worlds. It may transmigrate into another body. So there in Buddhism there is rebirth, but not necessarily an ascent into the superphysical worlds. So Sri Aurobindo is telling us that on the other hand, it might, obeying a turn of thought which is now beginning to gain a little in strength, admit a universal self or cosmic spirit as the primal reality and life as its power or agent, and so arrive at a form of spiritualized vital monism. So Buddhism may say, admit a universal self. They do not admit an individual self or a soul or the psychic being. But there could be a kind of a cosmic personality. They do not call it God, because again in Buddhism there is nothing called God. But they say there could be, Sri Aurobindo is telling us nowadays, it's not in the ancient times but in the modern times, there is a revival of Buddhism where they would admit a universal self or a cosmic spirit as a primal reality. Because if you ask Buddhism that what is the source of the creation of this world, then they might say there is something called a cosmic spirit or a universal self, which is a kind of the agent and arrive at a form of spiritualized vital monism. That means there is only one cosmic self, and out of that cosmic self all these individual personalities are born, and because of the elemental desire, the birth takes place, and then once there is a first birth, then we have added more desire, more karma, more associations, more images, and we make a personality. And when it goes to the next body, it may get rid of some of the old associations, but again add to it new associations, new experiences. So you see, this personality keeps growing, keeps sometimes becomes less, sometimes more, but it continues. But it continues till when? Till the time that all the desires are eliminated. Because this personality, if we say, there's a question of memories, ideas, associations, images. You see, behind all this, there's one element that is of desire. If I have relations, what is it? There's a desire. If I have associations, is the desire behind that. If it's an experience and sensations, there's a desire behind it. So behind everything, there is the primal element of desire. That's why the Buddha would always ask us to get rid of the desire. Because it is by drying up the desire that the personality dries up. And ultimately, that's what he would say, when this personality gets extinguished, that is called nirvana. So he says, in this theory too, a law of rebirth would be possible but not inevitable. It might be a phenomenal fact, an actual law of life, but it would not be a logical result of the theory of being and its inevitable consequence. Now having said that, Sri Aurobindo will take up, as he did before, the theory of the Advaita of Mayavad. Now we have said this before, but let's read first a little bit and then explain. Advaita of Mayavad like Buddhism, started with the already accepted belief, part of the received stock of an antique knowledge, of supraphysical planes and worlds, and a commerce between them and ours which determined a passage from earth. And though this seems to have been a less primitive discovery, a return to earth of the human personality. So this is what Advaita of Mayavad says. Yes, there are superphysical worlds, there is a soul. And these ideas, as Sri Aurobindo says, they have been taken from a received from an antique knowledge, the antique knowledge of Vedas and Upanishads. Advaita Vedanta of Shankara takes the same ideas, existence of the world, supraphysical worlds and the soul, and the soul goes into this world and returns to earth. At any rate, their thought had behind it an ancient perception and even experience, or at least an age-long tradition of a before and after for the personality which was not confined to the experience of the physical universe. For they based themselves on a view of the self and world which already regarded a supraphysical consciousness as a primary phenomenon and physical being as only a secondary and dependent phenomenon. Well, this is what Sri Aurobindo is telling us, is the basic tenets of Shankara's philosophy are pre-existent to Shankara because they are all there in the Vedanta. The question of the supreme reality, the question of the supraphysical worlds, the question of the rebirth of the soul, all these have been taken from the ancient philosophy. So that there is nothing new in that. So it was around these data that they had to determine the nature of the eternal reality and the origin of the phenomenal becoming. Therefore, they admitted the passage of the personality from this to the other world to other worlds and its return into form of life upon earth. But the rebirth thus admitted was not, in the Buddhistic view, a real rebirth of a real spiritual person into the forms of material existence. So here comes the catch, that they admitted the rebirth of the soul, but Sri Aurobindo says it was not a real rebirth of the soul. What does it mean that it was not a real rebirth? Is there a false rebirth? He explains, in the later Advaita view, the spiritual reality was there, but its apparent individuality and therefore its birth and rebirth were part of a cosmic illusion, a deceptive but effective construction of universal Maya. This is where he says, they have accepted all these theories of Vedanta, but ultimately they say, all this is only a cosmic illusion. If it is a cosmic illusion, then the whole story of rebirth and supraphysical worlds and phenomenal world, all that becomes something mitha, something illusion, something false. So you see, it's kind of, you know, you raise a huge structure and suddenly pull the carpet underneath that. So that's what, you know, Advaita tells us, that built a beautiful world, but at the end of it, they pull the ground from that building. So the whole system collapses. So that is why, although Buddhism, Advaita Vedanta of Mayavada, comes very close to what Sri Aurobindo would have said and very close to what Vedanta accepts, but in the last turn, when they say that all this is an illusion, then the entire philosophy falls on the ground. So we cannot really take to what Mayavad says, because ultimately there's no one bound, no one released, no one gets mukti in Advaita Vedanta or Buddhism of Mayavad. Now is a kind of a rounding off before he takes up the Advaita Vedanta of the Upanishads. In Buddhistic thought, the existence of the self was denied. And rebirth could only mean a continuity of the ideas, sensations and actions which constituted a fictitious individual moving between different worlds. Let us say between differently organized planes of idea and sensation. For in fact it is only the conscious continuity of the flux that creates a phenomenon of self and a phenomenon of personality. Well, in the Buddhist philosophy, we have what we said before, a fictitious individual moving between different worlds. Now, we have understood what is this fictitious individual, but what are these worlds? Because we didn't know that there were Buddhist philosophy accept these supraphysical worlds. And Jesu Abhinanda says that this fictitious personality moves between different worlds. And those worlds, he says, between differently organized planes of idea and sensation. So these are not the same worlds that we speak of as the supraphysical worlds. These are worlds that are there even in the subtle physical world itself, between the world of idea and sensation. That means, you know, what I'm experiencing now as whatever little experience I have. So the world is not above the mind. The world is surrounding and around our own world, the earthly world of sensations and physical reality. So if we speak of the different worlds, it is not the world of supraphysical. Let's be clear on that. Because it is Shankara, Vedanta, Shobindo who speak of the supraphysical worlds. But the worlds of Buddhism are only around in the subtle physical worlds close to earth. So in the Advaitic Mayavada, there was the admission of a Jivatman, an individual self, and even of a real self of the individual. But this concession to our normal language and ideas ends by being only apparent. You see, all the time this question of apparent, illusion, dreamlike, these are all applicable to Shankara. So philosophically, he has accepted the question of Jivatman. He has accepted the question of Atman. But then, as I said, he builds a wonderful palace, a beautiful building. But then he doesn't let it stay. He ultimately says, all that is only an illusion. So Sri Aurobindo is telling us again and again that this concession to our normal language and ideas ends by being only apparent. This is all this building is there, but actually it's not real. It is only, you know, like we see on a cinema screen, beautiful houses, people running around and all that, but we say it's only an image. You switch off the light in the power room and the whole image is gone. So what you thought, you know, the people there fighting and quarreling and loving and running and singing, you get engrossed in that, you get involved in that, but at one moment when the power is gone, the whole thing is out. Similarly, for Shankaracharya, the world is all beautiful, is all sorrow and suffering, is all active and all that, but then at one moment he says, you realize the Brahman, you contact the Brahman, and then this entire phenomenon called creation is nullified. For it turns out that there's no real and eternal individual, no I or you, and therefore there can be no real self of the individual, even no true universal self, but only a self apart from the universe, ever unborn, ever unmodified, ever unaffected by the mutations of phenomena. Birth, life, death, the whole mass of individual and cosmic experience become, in the last resort, no more than an illusion or a temporary phenomenon. Even bondage and release can only be such an illusion, a part of temporal phenomena. They amount only to the conscious continuity of the illusory experiences of the ego, itself a creation of the great illusion. And the cessation of the continuity and the consciousness into the superconsciousness of that which alone was, is and ever will be, or rather which has nothing to do with time, is forever unborn, timeless and ineffable. Well, a beautiful paragraph which gives you the gist of Shankara, his entire philosophy. Well, we have seen this very clearly, so I will not give an explanation. But as he puts it in one sentence, they amount only to the conscious continuity of the illusory experiences of the ego, itself a creation of the great illusion. So ultimately, you know, I gave you the example of watching a movie, your involvement, some people cry over the thing, some people get excited. So all this is an image of the ego. He says, ultimately, this game of the ego, this sentiment, this emotions, everything is illusion. And in fact, there's only one superconscient that, the Supreme Brahman, who has nothing to do with time, because he has not even created this world. He doesn't come down into the field of time. He is there in the timelessness. So he is ever unborn, timeless and ineffable. So Brahman alone is true. The whole world is an illusion. It is not an unreality, remember. It is an illusion. Well, if you want to call it unreal, yes, it is unreal in the sense that it is, you know, it is and it is not. Like we have an oasis in the desert, a mirage, that you see the green, the beautiful trees and the water. So as long as you see, you think it's there. But when you go there, you see the mirage is gone. It's a mirage. Nothing is there. So similarly, as long as we are in this world, we think it's real. But the moment we understand the true consciousness of Brahman, all this vanishes. Thus, while in the vitalistic view of things, there is a real universe and a real, though brief temporary becoming of the individual life, which even though there is no ever-enduring Purusha, yet gives a considerable importance to our individual experience and actions, for these are truly effective in a real becoming. In the Mayavada theory, these things have no real importance or true effect, but only something like a dream consequence, for even release takes place only in the cosmic dream or hallucination, by the recognition of the illusion and the cessation of the individualized mind and body. In reality, there is no one bound and no one released. For the soul existent self is untouched by these illusions of the ego. Well, I'm sure now the whole thing has become very clear. Because it's again the same thought of the Mayavad, and this is the sort of the sentence that has been repeated before also in Shri Aurobindo's own life divine. There is no one bound and no one released. So this entire philosophy of illusionism is only one sentence. No one is bound, no one is released. Because after saying all this question, we must do tapasya, we must do yoga, we must do all these things to get mukti, we must get salvation, we must be away from this suffering. Ultimately, if you ask him the question, who is getting the liberation? Then you say, I, my soul. That means your soul is a reality. No, it is not a reality. If your soul is not real, then who is getting the mukti? No one. Then why all this philosophy of doing tapasya and jnana marga and dismarga and bhakti marga? So you see, this whole thing is so paradoxical. But Shankara is right. Experientially, until you come to that point of disillusionment. You see, most of the human beings are wonderfully involved in this world, thinking this to be the absolute reality. It's only at moments when there is a tremendous disappointment, disillusionment. You say, what is the fun of all this? So it's a kind of an experience that brings you the truth of Shankara. But up until then, I think we are all jolly well involved thinking that this is the ultimate truth of the world, that this is the ultimate reality, and what I am doing is the greatest thing in the world. So all this is there jolly well. But those moments are rare, and if they come to anyone, I must say he or she is a blessed person. Suddenly to say, hey, is it all true? Is it really true that I am doing all these things? Is there this world? So that is the ultimate disillusionment. And I don't remember, there's a French writer on this level. Well, whatever. So there is, when this kind of a disillusionment comes in your life, then suddenly you get back and say, yes, Shankara is right. So Shankara, philosophically, there may be a lot of intrinsic paradoxes, logically we see. But experientially you will see that Shankara is greatly right. Because at a point you do reach and then question the reality of all this world. But of course, that's not the end of a spiritual experience. Because then you say, no, this is not unreality, this is a Brahman reality, there's a meaning. But we all pass through the stage of self-questioning and say, is it really true? So he says, to escape from the all-destroying sterility, which would be the logical result, we have to lend a practical reality, however false it may be eventually, to this dream consequence and an immense importance to our bondage and individual release. Even though the life of the individual is phenomenal only, and to the one real self, both the bondage and the release are and cannot but be non-existent. In this compulsory concession to the tyrannous falsehood of Maya, the sole true importance of life and experience must lie in the measure in which they prepare for the negation of life, for the self-elimination of the individual, for the end of the cosmic illusion. This is the explanation, what I was trying to tell you. That we know that ultimately this world is an illusion. But we have to pass through all the stages, experiences, levels, facets and phases of life in order to arrive at that moment of disillusionment where you can have this question of a withdrawal for the negation of life. You see, we are on the contrary so much into the positiveness of life that we are so much into, we have forgotten, I must say, ourselves in the present so much so, that we hardly get a moment to stand back and say, is it right? So Shankara would say, well, you go on through with your life, with all the Maya that is there. Maya is really blinding you with all the attachments and the desire. But until life gives you a slap and then you say, my God, I am awakened now. So the purpose of this life is to get towards that moment of negation of life. So you go through life only in order to deny life. So he says, go through. But if you go through it with a particular marga, with a particular way and a particular path, you are faster to realize the negation of this life, that all this is an illusion. Then we come into the next one, is Advaita Vedanta. This, however, is an extreme view and consequence of the monistic thesis. And the older Advaita Vedantism, starting from the Upanishads, does not go so far. It admits an actual and temporal becoming of the eternal and therefore the real universe. The individual too assumes a sufficient reality. For each individual is in himself the eternal, who has assumed name and form and support through him, the experience of life returning. Experiences of life turning on an ever-circling wheel of birth and manifestation. The wheel is kept in motion by the desire of the individual, which becomes the effective cause of rebirth, and by the mind's turning away from the knowledge of the eternal self to the preoccupations of the temporal becoming. With the cessation of this desire and of this ignorance, the eternal in the individual draws away from the mutations of individual personality and experience into his timeless, impersonal and immutable being. So what is the difference between Shankaracharya and the real Advaita Vedanta of the Upanishads? You see, Upanishads tells us about the reality of the world and the ultimate reality of the world, whereas Shankara said it is a temporary reality, but ultimately it is unreal. Whereas Vedanta tells us, no, it is a permanent reality. It is a secondary reality, but nevertheless it is a reality. And it is the same Brahman who has become this individual, you and me, and all these individual forms. So all these are real. There is nothing that is unreal. So it is the Brahman himself, the individual too, assumes a sufficient reality. And this ever-circling wheel of birth in the manifestation, now, you see, the individual, human being, why is it that he goes on coming into this birth again and again? For two reasons. One is because of his desire, and the other one is because of his ignorance. He says it's ignorance of what? Ignorance of the eternal self. You see, because we are not, we do not have the knowledge of the eternal self, we are reborn. So what does it mean? The moment you have the knowledge of the eternal self, then your rebirth can stop. And you will have the knowledge of the self, obviously, when you have no more desire. So desire and ignorance are interlinked. So he says, with the cessation of this desire and of this ignorance, the eternal in the individual draws away from the mutations of individual personality. So that individual in whom, that individual who attains this knowledge of the eternal, completes or stops or ceases his desire, that individual soul can return to Brahman and get merged in the Brahman. Whereas the rest of the world continues. So this is the Advaita of Upanishads. But there is a rebirth, and through this immense rebirth, there could be a possible of cessation of rebirth. But here what Sri Aurobindo is looking for is the question, does this Advaita Vedanta of Upanishad, does it make rebirth inevitable? So the whole theory here, what Sri Aurobindo is searching for in all these philosophies, is rebirth inevitable or not? Buddha said no chance, Shankara no way, Advaita seems to have given as an answer, But as you will see in the next paragraph, Sri Aurobindo says, sorry, even Advaita Vedanta does not make rebirth inevitable. It is necessary but not inevitable. We'll take that paragraph 17 in our tomorrow's class.